I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, Faith Perlow tells us about a huge gathering at Stonehenge to mark the start of summer. Later, Dan Friedel presents this week's technology report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Faith Perlow.
Around 8,000 people gathered Wednesday around prehistoric Stonehenge in Britain to observe the summer solstice. Many wore colorful clothing and even antlers. They stayed overnight to greet the sunrise on June 21st. It is the day with the most daylight in the Northern Hemisphere. The crowd greeted the morning sun, shining into the heart of Stonehenge with drumming, chanting, and cheering. Nicola Tasker is the director of Stonehenge at English Heritage, a nonprofit group that oversees many historic places in Britain. Tasker said Stonehenge continues to captivate and to bring people together to celebrate the seasons, just as it has done for thousands of years. She added there was a wonderful atmosphere from sunset to sunrise, and everybody enjoyed a very atmospheric morning. In addition to the 8,000 people present, English Heritage said that about 154,000 others watched on its live stream video. In the Northern Hemisphere, the summer solstice happened at 14:58 UTC on June 21st, when the sun travels along its northernmost path in the sky, said the Old Farmer's Almanac. The day also marks the start of summer in Earth's northern half. In the Southern Hemisphere, it's the opposite. The June solstice marks the start of winter, when the sun is at its lowest point in the sky. In China, the summer solstice is called Xiaoji. Beijing Tourism says it is a time when people celebrate the wheat harvest and pray for peace. And people eat vegetables, cold noodles, and what is commonly known as summer solstice cake. Northern European countries like Sweden and Finland celebrate the summer solstice by singing and dancing around the midsummer pole. In Ukraine, people traditionally gather to celebrate Ivan Kupala night in Khortytsia, an important historical area on the Dnieper River. The day is also known as the International Day of Yoga. On Wednesday, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi led diplomats and others for a morning yoga session at the United Nations. In 2014, Modi told world leaders at the UN, "Yoga is not just about exercise. It is a way to discover the sense of oneness with yourself, the world, and the nature." At Stonehenge, for just one night of the year, people are permitted to spend time inside the stone circle that is believed to have been built between 5,000 to 3,500 years ago. The purpose of the stone circle is still hotly debated, English Heritage notes several explanations. They include Stonehenge being a coronation place or crowning place for Danish kings. Other explanations are that the place was a temple, a center for healing, or a structure for astronomy, used to predict eclipses and other solar events. The organization said the most generally accepted explanation is that of a prehistoric temple aligned with the movements of the sun. The stones are said to line up with the sun at both the summer and winter solstices. I'm Faith Perlow.
The largest newspaper company in the U.S., Gannett, says it will start using artificial intelligence, AI, technology to write short versions of stories written by humans. The company recently announced a plan to use generative AI to add short pieces of information to the top of each story. Generative AI tools use machine learning methods to train computer systems on huge amounts of data to produce human-quality results. Gannett says it will test the system later this year. Human writers and editors will look at what the technology produces and decide whether it meets the company's standards for publishing. Ren Turiano is a top official with Gannett. He explained that AI technology can be useful to reduce tedious jobs currently performed by journalists. He noted that Gannett will test its AI system slowly before it is permanently deployed. Some news organizations launched the technology too quickly and experienced problems. This included cases where AI systems created factual errors in stories. Turiano said at Gannett, "We're not making that mistake." Other news organizations have said they are taking their time considering how to use generative AI tools. This includes the Reuters news agency, which provided the information for this story. Paul Bascobert is the president of Reuters. He said the news organization embraces AI, but he added that the news agency is seeking to use responsible methods to make sure the system upholds standards for accurate reporting. Earlier this year, two publishers, Men's Journal and CNET, had problems with AI-generated material. In January, CNET reported that a number of stories written by AI had appeared on its website without being checked by humans. Many of the stories contained mistakes. In February, Men's Journal published some AI-generated stories on its website that also contained mistakes. Some experts say one of the problems with AI technologies is that they can hallucinate or make things up that are not true. Nicholas Diakopoulos is a professor of communication studies at Northwestern University in Chicago. He told Reuters he thinks news organizations need to take their time with generative AI. Diakopoulos advises that news organizations not use such tools to publish stories without any human involvement in the process. Gannett recently announced it was cutting 600 jobs. Some of the journalists still working at the company worry that AI will one day replace them. In early June, hundreds of Gannett workers left their jobs for a short time to protest job cuts and low pay. The labor group that represents some of the journalists said the company's use of generative AI is one of its main concerns. Gannett, however, says the technology will not replace humans. Instead, it is designed to help employees be more effective and give them more time to do other more valuable work. Journalists from Gannett's USA Today publication are currently examining test stories written by its generative AI system. Gannett is also working to develop natural language generation technology. That system would write stories based on already confirmed facts. Reuters reports several large news organizations, including the New York Times, Washington Post, and BBC, are all working on AI tools to help create stories. Those companies say they are currently testing their systems. Bloomberg, a financial news organization, said it hopes to use AI to create business reports based on financial data. Miranda Marcus is the head of BBC News Labs. The group is testing AI tools that aim to write stories based on previously published information. Those stories are called explainers. But the BBC says it is being careful. Marcus discussed the stories with Reuters and said they would never be seen by readers unless a human journalist decided to make them public. Marcus said there are a number of ways AI could be used to help journalists. She called the current situation a whole other universe of what kinds of stories we can tell with these tools. But she warned, "We're not there yet." I'm Dan Friedel.
That was Dan Friedel with this week's technology report. Dan is here now to talk more about the story. Dan, it seems like media companies want to start using AI tools, but they are not quite ready to give them the green light.
You're right, Ashley. To give the green light is a phrase often used in Hollywood about movie ideas. It comes from the green traffic signal telling cars it is time to move forward. And I think that applies here, too. The media companies do not want the AI programs to make mistakes that can be seen by readers.
So what color traffic light do you think best represents how media companies feel about AI tools right now?
Well, Ashley, it looks like some of them are still waiting at the red light, but others are at yellow, which means move forward carefully. The companies want to let AI tools do some work, but also use human writers and editors as traffic control officers. This story says the big American publisher Gannett is probably somewhere between yellow and green, which means they are moving forward a little faster than the other companies.
I get the sense that writers are not so certain about the plans. Why are they worried?
Well, Ashley, people are worried about their jobs. Newspaper and media companies are reducing the number of workers all the time. The media companies say they are not making as much money as in the past. So they want to keep producing stories, but with fewer people. The journalists want to keep their jobs. You see something similar happening now in Hollywood, where the writers want to be sure AI tools do not take their jobs.
That is a good review of the situation. Thanks again, Dan, for joining us on today's program.
You're welcome, Ashley. Always happy to help.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
For 4 years now, to realize our vision, we have pursued a simple but profound strategy. Opportunity for all. Responsibility from all. A strong, united American community.
Americans elected Clinton as their 42nd president in 1992 and re-elected him 4 years later. In the summer of 1996, President Clinton's first term was coming to an end. He had established a mixed record of successes and failures in his dealings with Congress. He had greater difficulty in those dealings after opposition Republicans won control of Congress in 1994. All presidents face political battles, but in President Clinton's case, there was more to it. He and his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, were being investigated over their personal financial dealings in Arkansas during the 1980s. There were also accusations of womanizing from his years as governor of that state. But in the summer of 96, President Clinton's public approval ratings stayed above 50% and went as high as 60%. The economy had improved during his first term. Americans were getting jobs and spending more money. More people, and not just the wealthy, were investing in the stock market. In August of 1996, the Democratic Party met in Chicago and nominated President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore for a second term.
My fellow Democrats and my fellow Americans, thank you for your nomination. I don't know if I can find a fancy way to say this, but I accept.
The Republican Party held its nominating convention that summer in San Diego, California. The party chose former Kansas Senator Bob Dole as its presidential candidate. He had resigned from the United States Senate to seek the nomination. He chose former Congressman and Cabinet Secretary Jack Kemp of New York as his vice presidential running mate. Dole was a World War II hero who suffered a permanent injury to his right arm. He later served 4 terms in the House of Representatives. He was elected to the Senate in 1968 and re-elected 4 times. Another candidate in the presidential race was businessman Ross Perot. He won the nomination of the Reform Party, which he started a year earlier. He had also run for president in 1992 and received 19% of the popular vote. During the 96 campaign, President Clinton pointed to the stronger economy. He also campaigned on his legislative record, including new gun control measures and a higher minimum wage for the lowest paid workers. Bob Dole, in his campaign, accused President Clinton of spending too much. Clinton's answer was that he had stopped Congress from cutting too much from programs like health insurance for retirees. Bill Clinton and Al Gore easily won the election, defeating Bob Dole and Jack Kent. Ross Perot received just 8% of the popular vote this time. Clinton became the first Democrat to win a second term since Franklin Roosevelt in 1936. William Jefferson Clinton began his second term as President of the United States on January 20, 1997. His inaugural speech would be the last by an American president in the 20th century.
Let us lift our eyes toward the challenges that await us in the next century. It is our great good fortune that time and chance have put us not only at the edge of a new century and a new millennium, but on the edge of a bright new prospect in human affairs. A moment that will define our course and our character for decades to come. We must keep our old democracy forever young.
Clinton discussed some of the issues that the country continued to face, including racial divisions.
The divide of race has been America's constant curse. And each new wave of immigrants gives new targets to old prejudices. Prejudice and contempt cloaked in the pretense of religious or political convictions are no different.
During his first term, President Clinton appointed a large number of women and minorities to the government. As he began his second term, he chose the first woman to serve as Secretary of State. Madeleine Albright had represented the United States in the United Nations during Clinton's first term. And he appointed the first Asian American to serve in the cabinet. Norman Mineta became Secretary of Commerce. The Republican Party kept control of both houses of Congress in the 1996 elections. At the end of his first term, Clinton had gotten into a budget fight with the Republicans, which resulted in two government shutdowns. Those shutdowns did more political harm to the Republicans than to the president. In 1997, they reached a compromise. They agreed to a plan to end the federal deficit by 2002. In fact, the budget was balanced much sooner. In 1998, the economy was so strong that the government found itself with an extra $70 billion, the first surplus since 1969. President Clinton visited China in 1998. He spoke of his belief that in the 21st century, democracy will be the right course practically as well as morally, yielding more stability and more progress. A month later, in August of 1998, Al-Qaeda terrorists bombed the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The attacks killed more than 200 people. President Clinton ordered missile strikes against Al-Qaeda targets in Sudan and in Afghanistan in an effort to kill the group's leader, Osama bin Laden. Later in the year, President Clinton ordered military action in response to Iraq's refusal to cooperate with United Nations inspectors. The inspectors were searching for nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Clinton ordered missile strikes against targets that UN officials said could have been linked to such weapons of mass destruction.
Their mission is to attack Iraq's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs and its military capacity to threaten its neighbors. Their purpose is to protect the national interest of the United States and indeed the interests of people throughout the Middle East and around the world. Saddam Hussein must not be allowed to threaten his neighbors or the world with nuclear arms, poison gas, or biological weapons.
In 1999, Clinton deployed American aircraft and missiles as part of a NATO campaign in Yugoslavia. NATO was trying to stop attacks against ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. Yugoslav military leaders agreed to withdraw their troops. NATO stopped the bombing and sent an international peacekeeping force to Kosovo. The United States provided 7,000 troops for that force. Earlier in Clinton's presidency, the United States had led NATO airstrikes against Serb targets in the former Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia. The operations followed the killing of 8,000 Muslim men and boys by Bosnian Serb forces in Srebrenica, a UN-declared safe area. Clinton later pushed for the 1995 peace agreement to end the Bosnian War. The Dayton Peace Accords were named after Dayton, Ohio, the location of the Air Force base where they were negotiated. 3 years later, in 1998, Israeli and Palestinian leaders signed a memorandum of understanding at the White House. It called for Israeli forces to withdraw from some areas of the West Bank. The Y Memorandum resulted from 9 days of negotiations at the Y River Plantation in Maryland. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Special Diplomat Dennis Ross traveled repeatedly to the Middle East to work on the peace efforts. In 2001, President Clinton tried to get Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak to sign a peace agreement. Clinton invited the two leaders to the United States and held many hours of talks with them. Reports said they came close to an agreement, but the negotiations ended without success. Palestinians declared a new uprising against Israel. On trade issues, President Clinton, at the end of his second term, got Congress to approve permanent normal trade relations with China. That meant no more need for presidents to have to ask Congress for temporary renewals of those trade rights. Clinton argued that the move would create a better environment for democratic reforms in China, as well as creating jobs in the United States. Among other foreign policy matters during his presidency, Clinton normalized relations with Vietnam, and he supported the expansion of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, in Europe. Bill Clinton's presidency will be remembered, at least in part, for his efforts to reach out to the international community. But it will also be remembered for the impeachment trial in Congress that almost ended that presidency.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.